Good evening, one and all. I'm Joseph Cotto. Of course, the man you're here to see most certainly is my esteemed co-host, Paul Gottfried. We're going to be discussing some very interesting stuff momentarily. Paul, how's it going?
Fine. I already mentioned to you the health problems of my basset hound.
Yes, it's terrible.
So we'll go over those again.
I'll just say very briefly, because Otto does have his fans, that it looks like Otto might have a tumor in his leg. The biopsy has yet to return, but Paul and his wife are very concerned for Otto's welfare, as am I. So we just want to hopefully share positive thoughts, everyone in the audience, for Otto. He could certainly use them.
Yes, he can. He's everybody's favorite basset hound.
At least
for the people listening to this program.
No question. And by the way, folks, let me tell you about an epic story of hope, despair, peace, war, enlightenment, barbarism, the new world, the old continent, and above all else, the struggle for freedom. It is my new book, Eye for an Eye, a true story of life, liberty, murder, and the pursuit of revenge at the birth of America. Check it out on Amazon by following the link below. The Kindle version is $4.99 US, while the paperback is $12.99. There's even a hardcover for $22.99. If you are a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you can read Eye for an Eye for free. Hope that you enjoy the book. Now that that is dealt with, Paul, actually, I believe you are reading the book. Is that correct?
No, I've not yet received the book. I ordered it last week and am, you know, eagerly awaiting its arrival so that I can, you know, dip into the work, you know, and imbibe the wisdom therein contained.
Excellent. Paul saw a bit of it in a digital edition, but he wants the actual book, and I'm sure that he will enjoy, from what I gather, he liked what he read of it so far. So I think that if he likes it, it's fair to say that most people in the audience will like it too.
You're right. I did read about 20 pages and was duly impressed. I don't think the Spanish are going to come off looking very good in that what I read.
No, they don't. But I mean, there's so much more that people that you'll see beyond those 20 pages. At the end of the story, it'll be very obvious as to why the Spanish Empire is not favorably covered in my book. Although I think I did an honest assessment of their activities in Florida, all the same, and actually back in Europe too.
Yeah, and you do have a sympathetic discussion of the French Protestants.
Absolutely, the Huguenots.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, the Huguenots obviously have always held in high esteem, and they are the core subject of the book, but I mean, the book deals with so many things that are of relevance to people regardless of what their religious background is, so I think that folks will enjoy it. It's important for people in the West to learn about Western history because they sure as hell don't seem to know much about it, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It is, especially in the U.S., a lot of people here just sort of basically don't know that. I mean, they know that Europe exists, but they have no idea really what their heritage is or what the cultural traditions were that made the U.S. So I think it's important for people to learn about the European history of what's now the U.S. But obviously, Conservatism, Inc. and the left don't want to do that. The left arguably is more interested in it, though, than the right is, but not from the perspective of appreciating this European history, but from the perspective of destroying its memory.
No, I think that's true. It is interesting how many of the original settlers of this country were coming to escape the Counter-Reformation or the Inquisition, the Catholic Inquisition. This would include Sephardic Jews, French Protestants, and other Latin peoples who were Protestant and running away. And they land up in the United States. And many of them land up in the American South. Sephardic Jews and French Protestants in particular.
Absolutely. In Charleston, that was like the citadel of these groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it is relevant. The English war against the Spaniards sort of fits into this narrative. It was very often called the Black Spanish or the Black Legend of Spain, in which they're always made up to be the bad guys, as they are in Errol Flynn movies and so forth. But many of the people who were escaping here were indeed escaping from the Counter-Reformation or the Inquisition or something like that. I don't think most people care. I don't know, but is one of Biden's ancestors rather a Huguenot, although he's Catholic?
No, an Anglo-Norman from Ireland.
Ah, okay. But they would have been Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. They would have been. Some of them might have converted during the Reformation, but he was certainly raised as Catholic. So it's interesting, I mean, to see. Biden, of course, is someone who probably doesn't know much about his own background other than, a very sort of thin Irish hyphenated American identity. And his kids don't really seem to know much about anything other than trendy stuff, and in the case of Hunter, very shady stuff.
Yeah, I discovered that Biden comes from bouton in French, like button. Mm-hmm. It's a variation. Yeah. In
the sounds spell. Right.
Yeah.
He's
kind of button head.
Yeah, now you think about it, it actually sounds right, because button in English is, just another way of saying the French word, as you mentioned. So It actually does sort of go together. Mm-hmm. Now that I think about it. Anyway, folks, if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. I'm going to be reading from an article tonight, which I think everyone here will find to be of interest. It was published in Time. It was published there last week on the 18th of June, written by Kermit Roosevelt, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania. I could describe the article, but I'll just read its headline so you'll get the gist of it. Juneteenth's vision of freedom expresses American values better than the 4th of July's. Now, before we delve into his ideas here, I think you really have a good notion of them just from the headline, but a professor of constitutional law in the city where the United States came to be, Philadelphia, is saying that Juneteenth is a better exemplar of America than the 4th of July. This is really interesting because he should be someone who's very interested in the American founding, not only because of where he works, but because of what he does, being a constitutional law professor, but that he prefers Juneteenthism to the genesis of American constitutionalism goes to show where a lot of people who hold positions of quote unquote constitutional significance are, whether they're constitutional law professors, maybe whether they work at the Constitution Center in Philly, whatever. A lot of these people, even though they surround themselves with, basically trappings of America's founding, they certainly don't seem very fond of it.
No, that's absolutely true. Talking about Biden, there's a French term, bidon, which means fake. Bidonné is to sort of, put on the dog or to read. But, and then this is a fake bidon. It's a fake holiday, Juneteenth. July 4th is a real holiday. It has to do with the birth of a great nation, or what was used to be a great nation. Juneteenth is, as I mentioned before, the program is really part of the new leftist liturgical calendar. It fits in very well with LGBT month and whatever else is there. I don't know, lesbian month or differently abled month. I mean, it's like the calendrier revolutionnaire, it's like the French revolutionary calendar, or, the 1790s, or the Russian revolutionary calendar. All revolutions create these sort of fake Christian calendars. And this is one more example. Juneteenth means absolutely nothing. It has no significance. It is the day that Union officers reach Galveston, Texas, in the middle of June, months after the Civil War ended, by the way, to inform these blacks that they had been freed of slavery. Well, We know that the Union forces occupied Galveston in 1863, so that the blacks would have known. And then they lost, they came back, and so forth. They didn't. I doubt they first learned of this in the middle of June of 1865. I don't know what still existed of slavery in Galveston at the time. It was important to raise this up as another name for George Floyd Day, right? I mean, this is basically celebrating that because of white guilt for slavery. The idea that somehow we're doing this because we're all together, we're all united in our devotion to freedom. And I read some awful piece by David Kaufman in the New York Post to that effect. This is a unified. It's nothing of the kind. And you know what it means, you can see in the fact that there were people shooting and killing each other and celebrating Juneteenth. In all the major American cities, we had this, you know, to celebrate Juneteenth. And it was quite appropriate. This is not like the 4th of July. We're not celebrating the birth of the American nation, nor even the end of slavery. You know, you can celebrate an Emancipation Proclamation or something like that. This is a holiday that may have been celebrated by some blacks somewhere, but was suddenly elevated to a national holiday, which, by the way, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, other people don't even have. Only Martin Luther King, of course, has this. And then we have all of these liturgical months, you know, like LGBT month, Gay Pride month, and so forth. But it's simply part of the cultural liturgical transformation of the United States.
Indeed it is. And that transformation continues at rapid speed. Before I get any further into it, Paul, can you see and hear me well?
Yes, I can.
Great, because you're coming in a bit, I heard what you were saying, but you're coming in a bit sketchily there before.
Okay.
Yeah, you might want to come back out and come back in. It could be that, but sure. Just waiting here, obviously, for tech stuff. But anyway, I actually forgot to throw the link into the live chat before. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. I don't know why I forgot to throw the link into the live chat. I was just about to do it. But then all of a sudden, it escaped me. I guess what Paul and I were discussing was of such great importance that that I forgot to throw the link out there. But the link now is in the live chat, just waiting for Paul to come back in. Sometimes connections do get a bit crossed. That's a good way of putting it. But I think that in Paul's case, this will be solved momentarily. Paul, do you see and hear me now?
Very well. Do you hear me?
I do see you and I do hear you. It still sounds a bit sketchy, but I think it'll be fine. It should be. I think it should be okay. Anyway, so I'll read now a bit from this article in Time, once again, titled Juneteenth's Vision of Freedom Expresses American Values Better Than the 4th of July's. And it starts as such. By the way, Kermit Roosevelt. I would presume he's a member of the Roosevelt family, which I guess would not be terribly surprising for a host of reasons. Anyhow, Juneteenth, which commemorates, the emancipation of America's enslaved people, has been celebrated 157 times, but it was only made a federal holiday last year, acquiring a new official name, Juneteenth National Independence Day. And yet the 4th of July, of course, was already Independence Day. One might reasonably wonder, if we already had one Independence Day, why did we need another? This works as a question about the holidays, but also about the history. If July 4th brought Americans independence, why was Juneteenth necessary? The answer is that the two holidays, like the historical events, are about very different things. July 4th is about independence at the national level, dissolving the political bands that connect one people to another. In the words of the Declaration, Juneteenth, by contrast, is about individual freedom, breaking the shackles of slavery. Very interesting words there from Kermit Roosevelt. Paul, anything to say about them?
Yeah, I really wonder if he is descended from Teddy Roosevelt, whose son was Kermit. Mm-hmm. he may be black for all that I know. He just has that name. He may be a black person with that name. No, if I were teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and we're not Amy Wax, who was sort of held on by her fingertips, I would sound like that, or at least pretend that I'm gay or something. I mean, you know, you're dealing with a nut house, you know, and you simply have to fit in. So you have to write something like this, I suppose. I suppose one can make the argument that he attempts to make this is with individual freedom, and only whites had individual freedom, blacks and this is fine, but why must all of us celebrate this as a federal holiday? Why don't we celebrate white people who liberated the blacks from slavery, and they were enslaved by other blacks when they were brought here, right? And they, you know, they survived and they multiplied in large numbers, which was not true of black slaves anywhere else. So maybe we should celebrate the whites who, you know, who did this. But of course we're not, because it's simply one more guilt trip that we're laying on white people. I saw this picture, I think it was in the New York Post, in which they, next to the article, they had some black men saying that, and this was the day we were liberated, which means, of course, that we're not going to celebrate July 4th, because we're a separate nation, we're a separate people. And we are a victim people, and you have to bow down before us because we're designated victims. If this were the first time that this sort of game was being played, I'd find it mildly amusing. By now, I simply find it infuriating.
Mm. And skipping down, way down in the article, the real relationship between Juneteenth and July 4th is closer to inversion than completion. Juneteenth is the flip side of July 4th. July 4th celebrates the right of people to form their own political communities and make their own laws, including, if they want, laws that enslave people who are outsiders to those communities. During the Civil War, the Confederates honored July 4th as fervently as the Union and proclaimed themselves the loyal inheritors of the principles of Independence Day. Juneteenth, by contrast, celebrates the conquest and destruction of those enslaver governments in the name of universal individual freedom. I have to, before I read anything else here, I have to say, I don't really think Juneteenth is about individual freedom. It's not about, certainly isn't about the universal freedom of the individual. It's clearly a black interest holiday that's meant to be independence for the black people, not just from slavery, but in this day and age when the holiday was instituted on a national level, it meant independence culturally, politically, in terms of behavioral norms from what some would call white supremacy, or which basically just means in terms of blacks then living in a society that is largely populated and run by whites. So I don't think this is really a triumph for individual rights and liberties at all, Juneteenth. What do you think, Paul?
No, I agree. This is not about individuals. It's about black victim claims. It's what it always is. It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed since I was a young man. It just keeps going on. And of course, it requires either gullible whites or whites who want to stick it to other whites who go along with this. It's like they do the same shtick every time. I mean, by now I know it. I know what this means. By the way, there is one thing which is obviously true, that the Southern whites who celebrated this did not believe that blacks were equal. Hmm. They did not really see them as part of the nation. They sort of saw some like serfs. They were in a lower position, but they weren't the political, you know, they weren't politically responsible the citizen class from their perspective. Despite the fact that the Declaration of Independence seems to address all mankind, right? Mm-hmm. The appeal to natural rights. in reality, probably this is, you know, this was simply understood as rhetoric, and most mm-hmm. of these people did not understand this. Nor did Abraham Lincoln, you know, who up until the time of the Civil War was hoping to follow the plan of the Colonization Society and send blacks to live in Haiti or somewhere outside the United States after freeing them, which was considered at the time a very liberal plan. Mm-hmm. So one can say that, you know, the blacks can do one of two things. Either say that we are part of this nation, even though we were not in 1776, then a lot of other people weren't included in 1776, mm-hmm. right? Yep. So we simply became part of that nation later. Just as in ancient Rome, you had a patrician class, then eventually the plebeians were integrated into the other view is that we are perpetual victims, mm-hmm. and you owe us something, because your original declaration did not include us black people, you know, and therefore you're all going to have to celebrate this June, this phony holiday we're creating. You're all going to have to celebrate this with us. And we're even going to say it's better than your damn July 4th, which we don't care about because it's a racist holiday. So it's more of the same, you know, more of the same victim game. You did this to us. And Juneteenth is really a morally and spiritually a higher holiday than 4th of July.
You know, it's interesting talking about the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is, and you know this very well, but a lot of people don't. It's not a constitution. It's simply a political document, political propaganda, really. And the all men are created equal thing, even though I'm not a fan of the Declaration of Independence, even though I would have fought against the Continentals in the American Revolution, I think that the Declaration of Independence is not hypocritical in terms of all men being created equal. Meanwhile, a lot of the people who supported this declaration also supported slavery. Actually, I think damn near all of them did. But the thing of it is this: they did not view the black slaves as being fully human. Now, obviously, today that's, you know, an inhuman statement to make. But I'm not saying this statement in terms of any agreement with it. But I'm just saying that. The founding fathers did not view blacks as being fully human. So when they said that all men are created equal, in their minds, that did not apply to blacks, and they didn't see themselves as being hypocritical. So I think it's rather hard to call them hypocritical about this, because they had a different conception of humanity than is now acceptable.
Yeah, I'm not quite, I wouldn't go that far. I think Jefferson, Lincoln, Hamilton, others, can certainly consider blacks to be fully human.
Oh, I wasn't talking about Lincoln. I was talking about just the founders.
Yeah, the founders too. I mean, Adams, others, many of them were opposed to slavery. Even Jefferson had opposed slavery, though he had slaves. But their position would have been that although slavery is an unjust institution, it does exist here. But you know, the ideal situation would be if blacks were free laborers. But they did not see them as politically, they would not be politically part of that society, that they were not capable of exercising citizenship. Now, some, you know, some like Hamilton may have thought that at some point in the future, this may be possible, but they did not really see them as part, one might say using the Lockean term, part of the social contract, right? I mean, they could not be equal members of a political society. You know, I think that was generally the view. Now, there were some who actually did defend slavery and feel that this is sort of the natural condition of black people. But I think there is, in fact, a tension between the all men are created equal lines of the Declaration and the existence of slavery. But then I think that the Declaration is maybe several documents put together. You know, it's a document in which it's very clear it's being written by English, you know, Englishmen. Yeah. Who don't like the mother country. They're angry at the parliament or the king, and they therefore want their independence. But they do see themselves as Englishmen. They're property holders. They resent the fact that the English, you know, in fighting against them, incited these savage Indians against them, right? They definitely do not see as part of their society. So, you know, they're really very much people of a certain culture, time, and social position. But they do appeal to natural rights. And this is also true of George Mason and John Taylor and various state constitutions. So I would have to say at some level, they did believe that all people were created, you know, had an equal right to freedom, ideally. Although very, very few of them ever, you know, envisaged a time when blacks would be part of the political union. I mean, we know that Jefferson in his notes in Virginia quite explicitly says that, you know, blacks are really not fit to be citizens. And You know, they he considers slavery a problem. All these things are problems, but he doesn't want them to be citizens. Certainly, Lincoln, through most of his life, did not. That's why he wanted to, you know, free blacks, but also send them out of the country to live in a separate society.
At the end of the day, though, the founders were okay with slavery being legal in the U.S. Even if they personally disliked it.
You know, some of the ones in the North, like Hamilton, did not like slavery.
They didn't like it, but they didn't favor abolitionists.
Well, they did not favor abolition. They probably had the same view as Burke or Daniel Webster, that eventually you'd put it on the road to extinction, but not quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is something we'll put off, you know, for another time, until after we founded a nation and have attended to other things.
And it's interesting, before I get back to the article, the founders talked about how much they love liberty and this. This is where they are hypocritical, in my view. They talk about how much they love liberty, this, that, the other thing. However, they were angry at the quote-unquote tyrannical King George for not overruling Parliament, which would have been tyrannical. They wanted him to act as a tyrant, and when he said no, they claimed he was the tyrant. Their real problem was with Parliament, not the king.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, unfortunately, go ahead.
I mean, this is known. I mean, among others, Barry Shane did a book on the Declaration, which he makes this very clear, that the Continental Congress, you know, which had been meeting for years before the revolution starts, were basically angry at Parliament. Mm-hmm. The king was a constitutional monarch. We want him to do. There was some proposal that is, you know, put forth after the revolution starts, that, okay, we'll give you what you want, but you have to, you know, come to the British Parliament. You can be members of the, well, I mean, back then it wasn't like getting on a jet, you know, mm-hmm. like flying from Alaska to Washington. It probably took you like 2 months to get over there. So this was not going to work. But it's Parliament is, of course, the object of their grievance. And it is the Tory government of Lord North, you know, which sends him up a wall. The imposition of mercantile policies on them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was just going to say that a lot of Americans, though, are rather brain dead about this. They think that King George was a tyrant who was, you know, basically giving the founders the finger, when in reality, they wanted him to be the tyrant and they hated Parliament. Also, they were angry at England for purportedly setting the Indians against them, mm-hmm. as you mentioned. However, they wanted to encroach upon Indian lands that the crown had set aside for various tribes. So, in fact, the founders there were being the tyrants, not the British crown. This is where the hypocrisy comes in my opinion.
They're not being hypocritical. I mean, they're not saying they want to give Indians rights. They're just angry that the British, you know, incite the Indians against them. They're not going to be any nicer to the Indians. They'll probably be worse. They are, but they just don't want the British using the Indians against them, which was happening. And one of the main reason they go after the king once the revolution is over, who, you know, the king is blameless in this, but they can't go after Parliament since they create a system that is similar to the English system. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, the original plan in Madison is that this is going to be a republic and therefore a legislative with mm-hmm. legislative supremacy. So it's going to be a parliamentary regime without a king. So you can go after the king, but you don't want to touch Parliament.
It's interesting, although I will say that the founders, in perceiving the British to use the Indians against them, it's a little odd because the crown, which is to say not King George, but the government operating under him, which is Parliament, saw obviously the settlers in the colonies as being British subjects. So it wasn't that they were trying to use the Indians against the Americans in the abstract, because they didn't view the Americans as a separate people from the British. What it was that the British needed alliances with various American Indian tribes, and they were willing to give these tribes certain rights that the white settlers disliked. And the white settlers then said, no, Parliament's agitating against us, when in reality, Parliament was trying to find a balance of interest. And as we saw with what happened once the United States was established, these same white settlers were glad to inflict holy hell upon the American Indians, despite being quote-unquote liberty-loving people.
Yeah, well, the liberty was not for the Indians.
That's the problem. Yeah. That's the democracy.
Yeah, no, I really have never been able to find any kind of horrible grievance to justify the revolution, since, you know, I would invite George III to come back and to replace George Joe Biden any minute. The Parliament replaced this Congress. I don't know why I'm supposed to get angry. You know, this issue, by the way, came up when Bill Clinton was president, mm-hmm. and someone said, you know, that English government wasn't that bad. Because it was terrible. It was pretty good, you know. However, the English didn't want to send all their good troops over here to fight the revolutionaries, so they incited Indians. They bought these Hessian mercenaries in Germany, you know, where they were basically like slaves of the elector or the ruler of the of yep. that area. I don't think it was an elector.
The elector of Hanover, was that it?
No, it would have been Hanover. It would have been Hessen. It would have been a duke, a Großherzog, a great duke or whatever you call it in German.
Grand Duke of Hesse. Grand Duke right, of Hessen.
Yeah, so they simply had these people and they sent them over. You know, they gave them some money, so they came over and they were pretty brutal. You know, soldiers, they sort of took it out on these poor people, you know, in battles that were fought around New York City. They even scalped them. They treated them very, very, very badly. They scalped them or they used tomahawks or something or axes to kill Americans, revolutionary soldiers. So it was the atrocities committed by the mercenaries and the Indians that made these American colonists so angry, particularly in the South. We wanted to stay out of it, places like the Carolinas, but the Indians raiding people's plantations, burning them down. So the British did not fight the war in a very nice way. Mm-hmm. And they, at the end of the day, they probably, you know, deserve to lose because of the way they fought the war.
Of course, the American revolutionaries did not fight the war very nicely either, tarring and feathering people.
Oh, they were awful.
For the property they owned. It was very nasty. Now, the British, though, inciting the Indians violently against the settlers started after the Revolutionary War, obviously not before, when the Declaration was written and they said the British were on the side of the quote-unquote savage Indians, blah, blah, blah. But the barbarism, which was incited by Britain with regard to the American Indians, came about after the Declaration during the war. But, you know, there was a lot of nastiness on both sides. And it's hard to say that either side acted the true name of individual rights and liberties. If you look at either side, each one basically wanted power and it used different rationales to get that power.
Yeah, I have a sense of the British, though. They simply look upon it as a sort of like a bad investment. You know, we don't want to lose too many people fighting this war. And they finally decide, you know, we'll make peace with them. We'll just trade with them or something, which is what they do. Because, you know, right after the war, the United States and England are reconciled. And then you have the Jay Treaty with England and so forth in the 1790s. So they're reconciled rather quickly. And then there was a strong opposition to the war being fought coming from the Whigs. Edmund Burke gives these speeches like present discontent and so forth. Of course, he was being paid by merchants in the colonies. The American colonies at the time he does this, but the British didn't really have their heart in this. I mean, it was not, you know, the hearts and souls, whatever the term is, or mine. They were really not in this war. Nor was it very popular in England. One of the few people who do defend it is Samuel Johnson. It was very good. I wrote this very satirical piece that taxation without representation is not tyranny. You know, he said these people decided to leave England to go to the New World and they made their fortunes there. They can afford to pay, you know, some small tax to the English government. but it wasn't so much the tax. I think it was the mercantile policies, the attempts to interfere with whom they could trade, which was very important in the West Indies. They didn't want them to trade with anyone but British colonies and so forth. So it was these restraints that became annoying. And then the widespread nature of these taxes on glass and tea and all kinds of other stuff, which upset the colonists, who were not really used to paying taxes. You know, living charmed lives back then. Well, they paid taxes to their own governments.
With the colonial legislatures, absolutely.
Right.
I was going to say, here in Florida, Florida is the only part of the U.S. that did not go with Washington during the Revolution, or at least I need to be a bit clearer when I say that. It's the only part of the U.S. that was around back in the day under British control that did not go along with the Revolution. Mm-hmm. Florida remained loyal to the crown. It was basically an extension of the British West Indies. And a big reason why Florida remained loyal was because it had an excellent web of trade with the British colonies in the Caribbean. So the farther north you go, the less important the Caribbean is, and the more the grievances up in, say, Massachusetts start to make sense.
No, exactly. That's the case. Nor did the English, you know, incite Indians against people in Florida.
Oh, quite the opposite, in fact. Quite the opposite. As a matter of fact, not far from me, there was an American Indian town, and it was full of American Indians who served in with the crown during the Revolution. Mm-hmm. So this area has a thoroughly loyalist heritage, of which I'm very proud. Anyway, getting back to the article, as a matter of fact, my forefathers, some of them probably fought in the American Revolution on the British side. They probably came over from where they lived at the time in Ireland. They're Anglo-Irish to fight. So interesting. But there's a hell of a lot of American Revolutionary history that goes unmentioned and, generally speaking, unappreciated. All right, getting back to the article at long last. The states won the revolution, and we identify with the rebels of 1776. I'll just, you know, say very quickly, I'm not part of the we, but I'll just go ahead now. Mm-hmm. Reading. The nation won the Civil War, and we generally also identify with the government that defeated the rebels of 1861. I'll just break out of the article again to say I'm not someone who really rails on about the Civil War, but as a Floridian, I definitely would not have been fighting with the Union in that battle. Getting back to the article, though not as strongly or completely as we should. So I'll break out again when I say the author thinks that America should be more thoroughly identified with the Union side of the Civil War. Not a surprise, considering this author's political stances. Now, sorry for any confusion, getting back to the article. But this creates a deep instability in American identity. A house divided cannot stand, said Lincoln, and we cannot be on both sides of this war and still be one nation. We must pick a side. What we need to ask ourselves is who we are. The real heroes, no, sorry, but we need to ask ourselves is, who are the real heroes of the American story? The revolutionary patriots fighting for their state's independence, but complaining that their enemies were freeing the people they enslaved, or the Civil War era Americans who fought to bring individual freedom to others? I'm very glad Kermit brings up this question, because it's a question that needs to be asked. What is America today? And I'll reread the last part of this paragraph, which is so important. Kermit wrote, "What we need to ask ourselves is, who are the real heroes of the American story? The revolutionary patriots fighting for their state's independence, but complaining that their enemies were freeing the people they enslaved, or the Civil War era Americans who fought to bring individual freedom to others." Now that I've done reading that part of the article, I will say that it's very important that this question comes up, because Kermit recognizes, and he's honest about it, that you cannot synthesize the Revolution and the Civil War into one coherent whole, as a lot of people in Con Inc. do all the damn time, pretending that no, really, Abraham Lincoln was a continuation of the Founding Fathers. The spirit of George Washington was the spirit of the Union, as it burned down all those homes of Southern civilians and forced them toward the sea. That's real Americanism. Well, no, it's not. And I admire Kermit for saying, you know, you're really talking about two different American identities, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. Even though I totally disagree, or almost totally disagree, with Kermit's politics, I'm sure, he does point out something here that needs to be pointed out. And this is one of those cases where the left can be more honest than the right, because the right is trying to fashion this bullshit civic nationalist, proposition nationalism thing, identity. Identity is too nice of a word for it. And as such, it tries to cobble together all these muddled, contradictory ideas. But from here, a leftist, we a woke leftist, we see, a case where woke leftism operates in service of the truth, bizarre as that might sound. Paul, anything to say about what I brought up?
Or you know, I've been thinking about this problem for years. And why is it that the conservative movement beats up on the South all the time, you know, and treats these people as traitors and Nazis or something like that? I mean, they're really horrible people. I would think that one would treat the Civil War, even if you root for the Union side, the way you treat the American Revolution. You know, say, gee, we're happy we have our independence, and Washington was a great man, but the Brits weren't that bad either. You know, they were America's allies afterwards, and we're not going to beat up on them all the time. I turn on Tucker Carlson. He's screaming against these Confederates, and these are the enemies and so forth. And I mean, he's the most conservative of the conservatives on TV, and they're all doing this. You know, well, these are terrible people. And, of course, the Southerners, being almost like American versions of Germans, seem to be masochistic. You know, kick me in the head one more time, I deserve it. I really have, but it seems to me that the strategy behind this, if there is a strategy, is that by concentrating all of our hatred on the Confederacy in the South, Southern whites, we avoid having the United States being condemned and stigmatized.
Exactly.
In the same way, right? I mean, so that we are the good side, you know, we're fighting with Lincoln and Martin Luther King, and it's all these damn Southerners over here. They're evil. They're evil people. And of course, you know, there are many things that we simply don't recognize. That slavery would have gone away. We would not have slavery today. It was, you know, an institution that was becoming obsolete, and, you know, would not survive into the 21st century. And probably if it had not been fought in that, opposed in that fashion, as part of a war in which one part of America decimates the other part, you know, and then immediately tries to raise up the blacks at the expense of the whites whose land is being occupied, race relations would probably be better in the United States. I really don't see how Reconstruction did anything to improve race relations in America.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a disaster. But we have to say, and you have to also remember, there's 700,000 young men who die in this stupid war. Absolutely. You know, which left half the country devastated. But we have to go on blaming the South in a way that we do not blame the English for the American Revolution. We still, by the way, I think, blame the Germans even for World War One, but that's because Teutonophobia or Germanophobia is, you know, so much part of the establishment culture. But you know, we don't get angry at Mexicans for the Mexican War, as I said, more importantly, we don't get angry at the British for, you know, a war that lasts all these years, and then there's protests against the British that lead up to this and so forth. And in fact, we emphasize our common roots with them. And after the Civil War was over, by the 1880s, 1890s, the position taken by the central government in the United States, which was a wise decision, I totally believe, taken by people who were commanders in the Union Army, as most of those Republican presidents were, that we're going to say both sides were good. We're going to give pensions to people on both. We're all Americans, uh-huh. You know. And Lincoln is great. Robert E. Lee is great. That to me is the solution, right? Mm-hmm. What we have in America today is like the Spanish Civil War.
Exactly.
One side wins and kills off the other, screams, and then the other side comes to power and tears down the monuments. That's why we're tearing down all these Confederate things now. This is absolutely crazy what we're doing. You know, you just say that there were good people on both sides, and, you know, whatever, country stay together, that's good, fine. That's the end of it. But the fact that not just the left, but the conservative movement is so intent on sliming the South constantly, you know, is being done, I think, for the reason that I indicated. They simply do not want the entire country to be condemned with, you know, the critical race theorists and the black attacks on white America. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick out these people over here, and we're going to beat up on them, you know, and the rest of the country is fine. And Lincoln is great, and the civil rights movement, and everything else. And the Declaration of Independence contains the blueprint for the civil rights movement and so forth. So, and then of course you're going to get blacks to like you, which will never happen. But they want this is a kind of delusion, you know, in which they are so ensnared now. But I think this tactic of just going after the South, you know, sort of spitting and kicking around its corpse at this point, it's just tiresome. But I think it does, you know, it does fit what is perceived as a need to save the country somehow by just condemning one part of it, right? Or absolutely, condemning the slave owners in the South, or even the Southerners who didn't own slaves but fought on the Confederate side.
You know, it's interesting because I never thought of it as you just described it, where these people in the conservative movement, whether they are con anchor like Tucker Carlson, they know that what they're doing is not historically accurate, but they choose to do it anyway because to them it's important to save the idea of America from, you know, being subject to, you know, a comprehensive critique, I'll put it that way, by the right, lefties. However, this is and I'm not a fan of left-wing history, as people know, at least I hope they know, that they could easily read by checking out one of my books. But even though I'm not a fan of lefty history, there are cases where the left, even though it certainly doesn't get anything right in any all-encompassing sense, it comes closer to being honest than the right, where it does not, you know, waste time pretending that the founders were proto-civil rights activists, mm-hmm, nor does it claim that, well, at least now it's being more honest about it, not claiming, it's not doing the synthesis that both the left and the right used to do, where the values of the American Revolution were the values of the Civil War. So I think that the left is bad as it is. There are cases where it's more honest about American history, and this is one of those cases.
No, I think you're right. I don't know if the present woke left is, but if you go back to an earlier left, to a Marxist left, much of what they said about the United States was true. You know, even if you read someone like Howard Zinn, who was like an Americanophobic, you know, leftist madman, but when he talks about, you know, how these people coming off the ship from Ireland were just pulled into the, you know, into the Union Army, and there's finally a riot that occurs, and then in World War One, you know, the government pushes the United States into the war, uses all kinds of dishonest means. This stuff is correct. You know, I mean, I look at this, then you look at some official neoconservative history or con ink history, and you notice that, you know, they're both full of flaws. But in some ways, the leftist narrative seems a little more honest.
Absolutely.
The old left. I think they've gone crazy, the left. But, you know, what was the leftist narrative, let's say, in 1950 or 1960?
Oh, definitely. That's much more honest, mm-hmm, than the right wing narrative or so-called right wing narrative today. Right. Even some of the woke lefties can be more honest in cases like saying, you know, America really isn't this country that the conservatives claim it is. Although what the lefties claim, these woke lefties claim the country is, it's certainly not that either. Mm-hmm. But so many people in the conservative movement, whether it's the quote-unquote base wing of it, such as Carlson, or the, you know, usual suspect con ink types, they are more or less talking about a narrative that exists in their imagination. And as you brought up, I think they may well be doing this simply because they don't want to contribute to what they believe is the degradation of America as an idea. And it's important, right, to say America, right, as an idea, because to these people, America is not a traditional nation state with a history, heritage, and culture, even though it obviously did have a very definite history, admired history, a well-preserved culture, and a cherished heritage up until fairly recently. But today, people on the right don't look at America through the traditional history, heritage, culture lens. They look at America as an idea, and they, mm-hmm, want to conserve the idea. So for them, if somebody talks badly about the founding of America, it's attacking an idea, and that takes it to another realm, as opposed to, you know, people critiquing a nation's history in a more conventional sense. This is the problem with proposition nationalism. It turns countries into ideas. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, everybody has these abstractions as to what the country is. But me, in the meanwhile, these abstractions are perceived very subjectively. So there can't be much unity, because if everyone's ideas of the country really are just, you know, differences of opinion, and the country itself is an idea, then you're not going to get much other than conflict.
Yeah, it's also another part of this is that America's exceptional.
Mm-hmm. An idea.
Exceptional idea, right. I mean, the idea is so...
I think this idea-based nationalism is total BS. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, well, I mean, it does have a certain resonance in a society that has lost, you know, any kind of ethnic unity or any kind of real... shared historical roots. So you have to create myths of some kind, like Abraham Lincoln, universal equality, that, you know, he gave his life and all these Americans died, you know, to advance the idea of universal equality. I mean, it is the thing that will sustain a country that, a nation that does not have what are usually the prerequisites for nationhood, right? You have to create alternative vehicles to give people a sense of unity. The libertarians back in the 1970s, 1980s were talking about liberty, you know, and the free market and capitalism, but that's not going to do it. You have to find something else, something more substantive. I don't know whether this really is more substantive, yeah. but it does create a certain kind of high-minded ideal that we're all fighting for universal rights, for democracy. And that these are all implicit in the American founding, you know, even though we then betrayed them or didn't honor them perfectly. But then, you know, America was like refounded in the sacrament of blood, you know, with the American Civil War. Right. So and then there was, you know, again, the deferred promise to minorities, and there was race. But it would seem that we're finally here. But just as we're getting there, everything is falling apart. Maybe it isn't working that well, but you know, we should be happy. I noticed if you turn on Fox News, you get two diametrically opposed positions. One is that we're going to hell in a handbasket. Everything is terrible, right? The other thing is this is a we've never been in. I think the world reached its high point in the second or third year of Donald Trump's presidency, right? A little bit. But we can come right back up if we have, you know, I don't know, Nikki Haley or somebody else as president. When we restore it to wholeness. So when we finally reach the end, because we're no longer betraying the promise of America's founding, right? Or the American dream, we're going to have the dream. The dream means like buying a house or something like that, you know, having a barbecue at least twice a week.
With an American flag apron, of course.
Right.
You know, but this goes to show why the ideas-based nationalism doesn't work, because at the end of the day, an idea is an opinion. And if a country is just basically a big opinion, everyone's going to have different opinions as to whether or not this opinion is valid or not. So
you do have two opinions here. One is the opinion of the mass media, the educational establishment, that America is a worthless, racist, sexist, disgusting society that deserves to be torn apart or at least transformed with, you know, more Juneteenths and gay pride months and so forth, right? And total social engineering. This is like the same view you get in Europe, you know, Western Europe now. The other position is that we're, you know, an almost perfect society or a near, what was Lincoln's term, like a near perfect
union? A more perfect union or something. What did he?
It was something like an almost perfect society or something. The neocons always quote this. I just forgot this line. But, you know, by doing something like electing a Republican president or winning back Congress, you can, you know, you can go back to being the near perfect or perfect society. And all of these terrible sins of the past, like sexism, homophobia, racism, we're sort of absolved now, right? Because we have laws passed against this, and we've cleansed our mind of prejudice sufficiently so that we can live in this true America that was already implicit in the founding. It just took hundreds of years to get there.
You know, obviously, neither one of these narratives, which is really what you're talking about, narratives of America, account for the totality of America. But it's you know, they're just opinions, which goes back to what I was saying, where you have this proposition, ideas-based nationalism. It's inherently going to fall apart because it's too rooted in subjectivity. Now, I was going to say that Lincoln did use the words "more perfect union." Obviously, he was quoting the Constitution, but he used that, but he did use something else that I think that you were referring to, although exactly what it is beyond me. I will say this, trying to figure out how to put it nicely before I read the last bit of the article and then we go to Streamlabs, but there was certainly a utopianism, a too high-minded idealism in America, even back when it was understood to be a more traditional borders, language, culture, or history, heritage, and culture driven nation. You saw it in the Constitution itself. I mentioned the words before, more perfect union. When you use language like that, obviously there is a great deal of idealistic activity going on. And a lot of Americans really did believe that their country could be like something never had before, something that would last forever, something that was of divine significance, let alone human accomplishment. And this eventually did lay the groundwork for Wilsonian neoconservatism.
Yeah, of course, Wilsonianism is sort of a stage moving toward neoconservatism. It's a more advanced stage. But then there were certain things that used to be taken for granted, right? That America was a Northern European, English-speaking Protestant country. I mean, that was taken for granted well into the 20th century, even at the time I was born, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was at least an implicit assumption about the American enterprise or the American experiment. We have to always remember John Jay, Federalist too, about, you know, how fortunate we are because we're a country with the same culture, ancestry, religion, and so forth. So there was the assumption that there would be certain commonalities, you know, and these were historically rooted commonalities. What made America exceptional to these early Americans was that, you know, it was a Republican form of government, and that they operated in their own space, you know, thousands of miles away from Europe, right? They had their own continent, in fact, which they had to share with Indians they proceeded to eliminate. It was the geographical situation of the United States that was very important, because they had their own continent, they had manifest destiny, they had a Republican form of government. On the other hand, they didn't see themselves as being all that different from Europe. You know, already in the early 19th century, you have people running to Germany to study. You have an Anglophile upper class. You know, they go to England. People are interested in things French. So they do have contact with Europe, and they admire very much that it's European. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was also harder to travel back then. It was quite perilous to travel. But, you know, they did see themselves in some ways as an extension of Europe. And they shared, you know, ancestry, language, religion, and other features of life with the Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you look at a lot of older American cities like Baltimore, particularly the Mount Vernon neighborhood, you will certainly see how there was a lot of European, mm-hmm. in that case, particularly British influence, right, in what became part of the United States. Of course, Baltimore eventually became something else, which you really can't get into here, but it certainly did change. And now Mount Vernon is surrounded by some not so nice stuff. That's a very kind way of putting that.
I thought you would say it became a German city.
No. It did not. No, it became something else. Mount Vernon is today this little jewel of Baltimore, surrounded by... I was going to use a term that I thought was
by a black ghetto.
Put it that way too.
It's sort of encroaching on the area, so that even, you know, if you go into the Peabody, you're not quite safe coming out at night.
Baltimore is something else. Lord Baltimore would not be pleased by it. I'll put it that way. He'd probably demand his name be taken off of the city. And who could blame him, really? Anyway, folks, now this is the call before the last call. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. From the Daily Zoomer, why do a lot of boomer Republicans call lefties communists? They are much more like anarchists, even though they also can be statists as well. I think, I mean, this is obviously a great question. I think that a lot of the boomer Republicans you described do this because they were the last, well, they were actually, no, the Gen X was the last generation to grow up with the Soviet Union being a big deal. But a lot of the boomers are so used to the Soviets being basically the cause of anti-Americanism, of agitation against the traditional American life, that it's easy after a while just to roll up anything on the left that's disliked into communism. And that's why a lot of these same boomers reactionarily oppose Russia today at anything that it does. So I think that you're correct that today's lefties are much more like anarchists, even though they could also be statists as well, as you mentioned. They're really anarcho-tyrants, and anarcho-tyranny is something which Paul has written about at length. But I think that a lot of boomer Republicans call lefties communists, even though they certainly are not Marxist-Leninist ideologues, because it's just an easy title to describe someone who is acting in an alien way to American traditions and who's obviously, you know, not on the right. Paul, anything to say about what the Daily Zoomer brought up?
Yeah, I agree with what you said, but I think there's a second, more sinister motive why they do this. The essence of the contemporary left, as I've argued again and again, is wokeism. Mm-hmm. It's the attack on the white race. It's the attack on gender identity. Biological gender identity. It is an attack on the structure of the family and so forth. Communism was none of these things, really. I mean, it was a socioeconomic tyranny that it created, but it was not culturally radical at all. In fact, look at communist societies. They're very stodgy. They, you know, control pornography. Treat homosexuals they treat them very vindictively, in fact. The people we see today are not Marxist at all, but the media really doesn't want to deal with them, because the conservative media is now, you know, accepting the transgender, it accepts gay stuff. It doesn't quite go as far as critical race theory, but will beat up on the Southern segregationists all the time and celebrate the civil rights movement. So they don't really want to deal with the cultural radicalism, unless it is to point out occasionally that, some male claiming to be a woman is in a trans, is in a swimming contest or something like that. That's about as far as it will go. There were absolutely resounding celebrations of Gay Pride Month on Fox News, if you watched it. They even had a 7-year-old child who was being transitioning, and they were, but Dana Perino was slobbering all over the how wonderful this is. So they don't want to deal with cultural issues. They'll get the left, take those. So what do? Is they say we're still fighting communism, we're fighting Marxism, right? I mean, they might as well be fighting, the Peloponnesian Wars. I mean, they just drag this stuff out. It has nothing whatever to do with the war that they're in. And, I suspect the most cynical motives for this, as I said, that, they do not want to deal with the left as it now is. They would prefer dealing with the left, as the Soviet Union or the Marxist or the socialist that they were fighting back in the 1960s or 1970s.
And from Dr. Bob, as an Anglo-Hebrew Calvinist, here's my obligatory down with popery post. In regard to Juneteenth, why must repubs like Senator Cornyn simp like an incel on OnlyFans? Is raising the share of the black vote from 8% to 12% worth destroying one's own nation over. Quite obviously, I think from any reasonable perspective, it's not Dr. Bob. I would say that I don't think Cornyn is really doing much because he cares about black votes. I think that he is virtue signaling to whites who are educated, who live in the urban and suburban areas of Texas, which are becoming more Democratic. I think that he is signaling to them that I am not one of those Republicans they have to be embarrassed about because I'm going to say something that could be perceived as racially, not even offensive, but even vaguely insensitive. I am down with the current thing, so I am in your polite company. Please vote and donate. I think that that's the message that Cornyn is sending here. I really think that, that's why he's doing what he's doing. Speaking of cynicism, as Paul was saying before, but I think that he's not trying to really increase the black vote in the GOP. I think this is about him trying to appeal to fellow whites in Texas. And Texas is not as conservative as a lot of people think. It's basically hanging on now for the GOP, and I'm sure it will hang on this year in November, but it's hanging on now for the GOP because of the Tejanos, who are principally clustered in the Rio Grande Valley, obviously near the Mexican border. So other than that, if it weren't for these Tejanos, Texas would be like in a Georgian situation, I think. And what's happening in Texas is that just as in Metro Atlanta, there's been this wave of Democratic PCSJW sentiment in Dallas-Fort Worth, in Austin, to a lesser extent in San Antonio and Houston, there have also been big waves of wokeness crashing down. And I think Republicans like Cornyn are trying to keep up with that. Paul, anything to say about what Dr. Bob raised?
Yeah, I'm not, except for his involvement with the gun control laws, is there anything else that Cornyn has done that I'm unaware of?
He was very slobbering over Juneteenth, I'll put it that way.
I'm sorry you told me. I think Joseph is right. I think they're concerned with, white suburban women and who unfortunately went to the colleges and studied the wrong things. I don't think Texas is quite that radical. I think it simply still has a much larger proportion of white conservative votes than Georgia. Probably the proportion of blacks to whites is probably lower than it
much
is.
Much lower in Texas.
Yeah, which I think. And of course, you have the Chicanos who are now turning to the right politically.
Tejanos in Texas.
Yeah, yeah. But I would suspect that, Cornyn was slobbering for all the reasons that Joseph mentioned. I try not to listen to this because I suppose you have to vote for one of these two god awful parties. And I vote for the Republican as the lesser of two absolutely despicable evils. But if I listen to Cornyn, I might not be able to do that.
And from Wojak Woes, how about that Juneteenth event held in D.C. last weekend? It had the ambience of Wimbledon or the Jazz Festival. I have the feeling that D.C. or Baltimore won't be Geneva anytime soon. What do you guys think? P.S. Switzerland has welfare and big government, too. I think what Wojak is bringing up here is that Switzerland, even though it has a highly decentralized model, that goes without saying, in its cantons, there are welfare states and governments that are not, so small they drown in a bathtub. But despite that, Switzerland has much more stability, that's a good way of putting it, and a higher quality of life than these American cities do. So Wojak is saying that it's not necessarily a large government or welfare that destroys the cities. It's the people in the cities that destroy them. And this rather unique Juneteenth celebration in the glorious nation's capital, which one could call it like Wimbledon or the Jazz Festival if they want to have some fun. It goes to show that the people turn these cities into what they are. The typical Conink argument that it's liberalism, it's big government, even though I'm not a fan of these, governments that micromanage people and that have high taxes and welfare states that encourage basically people to do nothing with their lives. All the same, unfortunate as what I just mentioned might be, it is not the determining factor in the destruction of these cities. It's the people in these cities. And now the destruction did come in really is in terms of what we now see with the Great Society, and that definitely was welfare statism. But the thing of it is that the Great Society's welfare statism impacted America's urban populations differently than the analogs of it impacted urban populations in traditional Europe. So it's the people. It's the people, not, you know, talking about welfare or big government, even though welfare and big government are not great at all. Paul, anything to say about what Wojak brought up?
Yeah, I remember a statement made by my late friend Sam Francis in addressing a libertarian conference in which he pointed out that he would rather live in a communist Sweden than a capitalist Guatemala because of the population, obviously. The only thing I wanted to add is that Mayor Bowser was asked, but what about this crime? She says, and it was done with a gun, you know, as if we had more gun, of course, Washington, I think it's banned guns, but then the argument is to people living around Washington buy guns or something like that, as opposed to people using cars, as the fellow did in Waukesha, to run people over without a gun. You can do it with a car if you want, or a knife or a bomb or anything else. But the fact that she focused on gun control, I mean, this is the answer. That if we confiscate more guns from law-abiding citizens, all the crime in Washington presumably is going to end.
To say the least, that is not a reasonable perspective in my eyes.
No, but it probably made her popular with Democratic voters.
Oh, I would imagine so, telling them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And now, unfortunately, folks, I'm sorry to say it, but this is the last call. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul, for the co-host of this show, sorry, just too busy laughing at the last Streamlab brought up, please do send it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. I might have jumbled the words there, but this is the last call. Thank you. Now, it's really something else to see how America's cities have declined. It's quite shocking. Although I'm not terribly sorry for these cities, even though it's sad to see from a human standpoint, because a lot of these cities brought this upon themselves.
Yeah, it's true. I always tell people that, I can remember, this goes back to 1966. Mm-hmm. I was in New York City and I had a car that my father bought me. It was some broken down, I don't know, German or French car, small car. And it broke down on 125th Street in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And there was a gas station open and it was owned by blacks, of course. They helped me take the car over and they fixed it. And I walked over to the 125th Street station. There was one more train going back to New Haven, or Bridgeport, where my family lives. I don't remember where I went, but I went. And the next day I went back and the car was fixed. And, you know, this black gas station mechanic, owner mechanic, did a perfectly, good job. I did not have to worry at that point about high crime. A few years later, I mean, once you had the civil rights movement going and riots in the cities and protests, I would have abandoned my car and run away at that point. But by the 1970s, in New York, the crime was out of sight. Mm-hmm. And the crime, even now, has not reached the point that it did in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my father was a policeman in New York during the late 60s and the 70s, right. And the 80s, too. So, mm-hmm. Obviously, I grew up with stories of how bad things were then. It's interesting, but what are today hellholes like the South Bronx, which is where he grew up. Well, it's where he spent a lot of his years. He wasn't born there, but they weren't terribly bad by his description back in the day. They were Greek, Italian, and Jewish. Mm-hmm. And then other people eventually came in and everybody fled to Long Island or to Riverdale.
Right. Yeah, the degeneration of Bronx was enormous. I mean, like Tremont Street and Fordham Parkway. They were beautiful areas. Fordham Parkway was lovely. Now you don't even dare walk there. That's where Fordham University is. I visited it. I gave a talk there a few years ago. And they only let you in. There's a policeman who comes. And it used to be very safe. And you sort of think back, why has this crime exploded? And you just say minorities have moved in. I mean, that's true, and they have a higher crime rate, but it still doesn't explain the extent of the explosion. You know, even if people were living in black neighborhoods when I grew up, the crime rate was not out of sight. It may have been slightly higher than in white areas, but it wasn't all that much. It just exploded the crime rates in the 1970s, and they went down for a while in New York under Giuliani and even under Bloomberg. It wasn't that bad, but under de Blasio, the crime just soared once again. You know. Although I don't think we have reached the 1970s level
yet. Not yet, although I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately. It's interesting because, you know, the slums in the Bronx do have some pretty nice scenery, bizarre as that might sound. There's a park called St. Mary's Park with a giant rock that people used to climb. He showed it to me when I was a boy. And it was in the 90s when it was not safe, but you could walk around there. Today, I mean, obviously you couldn't go out to see anything like that. It would be not cool. But, you know, even in the 90s, it wasn't a very nice place. But everything is a matter of, I think, degrees. It's all relative. So, the decline of American urban centers has been crazy. Also, your hometown of Bridgeport saw a nasty fall as well.
Yes, no, it's Bridgeport has been declining since the Second World War, when the population swelled to almost 300,000 because of war industries. Then after the war, it began going down. Then I think it may be the largest city in the state. That's only because New Haven and Hartford have declined demographically even more than Bridgeport. But Bridgeport has a smaller population now than when I grew up and when it was the third largest city in Connecticut, Waterbury being the fourth. Waterbury is probably uninhabitable at this point.
I'm just looking. New Haven has 145,000 people, and Bridgeport has 145,000 people. My apologies. New Haven has 130,000. Obviously, these cities have seen an immense decline in their population.
Right.
They were built to be much larger than they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I grew up, Hartford was the largest city, followed by New Haven, and Bridgeport was third.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Waterbury has only 107,000 people now.
That's about the same as when I was growing up.
Really?
Like years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed.
It has pretty, I'm looking at it, pretty architecture, but I wouldn't want to get out and walk around.
No.
it's kind of like the city of Lancaster, which has beautiful architecture, but you wouldn't want to walk around a lot of it.
In certain areas, although Lancaster is not as bad as Waterbury or Bridgeport, it's still a much nicer place.
Better than the South Bronx.
Or Hartford.
Yes, yeah. Hartford, of course, is terribly nasty in itself. It has a reputation, obviously, for insurance companies, but not a nice city to get out.
It used to be a beautiful city. It was one of the most beautiful cities in the United States, Hartford. Mm-hmm. It was not only insurance, it had beautiful parks, and the capital area was nice. Crime rate was very low. Back in the 19... There was a movie made a few years back in which this woman falls in love with some black laborer and her husband turns out to be a homosexual.
Oh, that was Far From Heaven. I was Julianne Moore, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it depicts Hartford when I was... the time I was growing up as, you know, a hellhole of racism. And it was a beautiful city. Mm-hmm. What they're talking about.
Yeah, it's looking at, you know, some images of it now. I've never been there, but it does, you could tell it used to be a very nice place.
But
things change. Another place that used to be very nice, and a lot of people are going to laugh at me, it was St. Louis. St. Louis had some of the prettiest parks in the country, probably in North America. And today, unless you're pretty much south of what's Del Mar Avenue there, it's not the nicest of places to be in.
No.
But St. Louis has some of the prettiest urban residential architecture that you'll find anywhere in the world, in my opinion, not just in the U.S. I mean, it's like astounding.
It is. And of course, you even had some of the fairgrounds from the, you know, Take Me to St. Louis, the movie. They were beautiful. You know, they preserved them. And you're right, they had some of the nicest parks in the country. And then around Washington University, the whole area was lovely. It is one of the most deteriorated cities that I've been in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's shocking because the deterioration happens quickly. But I mean, it really is a city that could have been so much more. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's one of those things that, you know, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it never goes back in again. Some people say demographics are not destiny, but I am inclined to disagree. I do think that demographics do bring with them quite a bit of destiny. Sorry, Paul, are you there?
Yeah, here I am.
Great. Yeah. So it's, yeah, it is very sad, the decline of the American urban center, but I don't see it being turned around. Some people are hopeful for some sort of renaissance or revival, but I think it's basically impossible because even a lot of the white lefties who move to these places as gentrifiers don't really create something better than what was before. Yeah. They just restore, in a very limited sense, certain neighborhoods. And, you know, very often they wind up leaving after a while because the old people and their old ways return.
Yeah, I think a major problem, you know, is that you do have these sort of black inner cities that are full of crime, you know, people shooting each other and so forth. Now, the reaction that we get to this is we have the so-called conservatives. These are fine people who are shooting, and they're just victims of the Democratic Party. They have nothing to, you know, they're just victims. The Democratic Party did this to them. Then you get the left saying that they're victims of white people, and we have to do is flood your TV stations with blacks and black programs all the time. And in schools will tell you you're damn racist and you have to atone for being this, and blacks are morally superior to whites and so forth. Now, both are crazy reactions. What has to be done is people have to be held accountable, you know, operating on the assumption that these black people have, you know, are acting by their own agency. You're putting up with this. You are committing these crimes. You're going to have to deal with these problems. But it is the lack of accountability that I find absolutely appalling. You know, if the people who are committing these crimes and people living in these neighborhoods were, you know, held responsible for their action, you know, not treated as victims, but held responsible, not having a George Floyd celebration every day or deploring white racism and so forth. But, you know, if the criminals were treated appropriately, just gotten rid of, and people were told that if they commit violent crimes, they're going to have hell to pay for it. You know, another problem is these black communities. Blacks will protect other blacks, even if they're criminals, which is a serious problem because they're not holding members of their own community to standards of decency. You know, it's simply the blacks against the whites. An attitude, by the way, which is encouraged by the white left more than any other group. And we have to stop this ridiculous celebration of black. This is ridiculous, the celebration of blackness. You know, you learn Mary Queen of Scots is black, and George White. Everyone is black, right? Mm-hmm. And every ad is this and this, and you see blacks, and then you turn on, and every movie is either black or homosexual. They vary, or LGBT, or something like that. And we have to just stop this nonsense. And people who are committing crimes have to be held accountable. I mean, that's the answer. And they'll scream, you know, brutality and this, even if it's a black policeman and so forth. But there is no accountability in the end. And there's excuses made. The excuses are absolutely damnable. And, you know, people, whether it's Krasner or Bragg or any of these district attorneys, some of them must be gotten rid of. You know, you need people like Mayor Rizzo or Giuliani in New York, or somebody who's going to control the situation and hold people responsible for their actions, and stop pitting and saying they're victims. They're victims of the idiots they vote for. They vote for those horrible people. You know, they're victims of their own horrible choices in life.
They are, and no doubt they'll keep making these choices and blaming someone else whose group's name begins with a W and ends with an E for the outcome of those decisions.
No, I think it's true. And, you know, also the white nationalists bother me because these people really can't control. Of course,
absolutely.
They can't control themselves. They're not doing it now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 1950s. It was very low black crime rate. You know, and they lived in two-parent families, went to church on Sunday. You know, they're like other people. Mm-hmm. They may not have done as well, you know, in school or the same intellectual aptitudes or interests, but they were certainly decent people. And the thing is, you know, you ask what has become of them? You know, why is this accepted as the normal situation that they wreck your cities, that they destroy buildings, they shoot up every weekend in Chicago, which are making unlivable. And you look at the governments that they elect, they're absolutely detestable, despicable human beings they put in power who make everything even worse.
And I don't think that the trends within Black American politics are going to change anytime soon. A lot of Republicans say, you know, the Black community is becoming GOP, but I think that's a massive cope, particularly with regard to the Black American community. Yes, the GOP can get more votes from Caribbean Blacks and Sub-Saharan African immigrants, but they're not going to get much more out of the Black American community.
None. Nothing.
It's a lost cause to use, not to sound like someone who's nostalgic for the Confederacy, of course.
Not a Confederate lost cause. a lost cause that we don't remember very fondly.
Absolutely. Anyway, folks, thank you very much for having tuned in tonight. Paul, I trust you've enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, I have. I blew off steam.
Excellent. I hope everyone watching this enjoyed it as well. I will just let you know that I do have a new book out. You can find it by following the link below. It is on Amazon, Eye for an Eye, A True Story of Life, Liberty, Murder, and the Pursuit of Revenge at the Birth of America. If you like this show, I imagine you will enjoy the book. So anyway, that is that. Take it easy, everyone. Have a great week, presuming that it will be a week until you see Paul and I again. Maybe not, maybe over the weekend. Our schedule's been thrown out of whack a bit as of late, but we'll try to get it back on course. But anyway, regardless of whenever it is that you see us next time, do take good care until then. Thank you very much for tuning in. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the show, please send a monthly contribution. Follow the Streamlabs link below and click monthly tip. You can also donate to Cato Gottfried by clicking on its PayPal link. This, too, is in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Cheers.